This second talk I have entitled, Why? My first talk was about where, the importance of mission, to knowing where we are going, to know the story. Ultimately, that is what gives meaning to our life, to know the story that we're in, the narrative thread, the where. The second talk I call Why. I'd like to start off with a little bit of philosophy. I guess I'm an engineer, so most of the Apollo stuff is right up my alley. But then I got to seminary, and I had to learn philosophy. And I'd had not one philosophy class, so just to show that I'm not purely the math and science guy, and I know we have people from all different departments, I'll try to speak to some philosophy now to appease the rest of the group. But I think you'll see how this fits in. One of the things that we learned in seminary in our philosophy of man class, in our ancient philosophy, the philosopher Aristotle. Now, probably we've heard of Aristotle, but maybe couldn't name exactly any particular thing he taught. He was some ancient Greek guy who we should know about. One of the things that I think could be relevant and important for us here today is his teaching on the four causes. Now, he uses cause in a very specific way here. Anything that exists, any concrete existing thing, he says, does so through four causes. There are, you can kind of think of it as reasons a little bit. The first of which is the material cause. Now, an example might help here. So, for instance, we can use a statue as an example. Say you were going to have a statue. Well, the material cause for that statue, then, it answers the question, what is it made out of? The material cause of the statue might be its marble. It's a piece of stone. It's marble. It's granite or something like that. That would be its material cause, the stuff that it's made out of. It's part of why it exists. It's a rock, ultimately. And there's the formal cause. Ask the question, what is it? It's not just a rock. We can look at it and say that's it's not just a rock, it's a statue. I can see it's in the shape of Jesus or the Blessed Mother. That rock is no longer just a rock. Its material cause combined with its formal cause tells us it is what we would call a statue. It is in the form of statue. Third cause is the efficient cause. How did this rock get to be this statue? Who took the material and put it into the form of statue? In this case, the efficient cause would be the sculptor, the artisan who did it. That would be the efficient cause. Who made it? Who did it? The last cause is the final cause. This answers the question, why? And hence is kind of the basis of this talk. I think this is perhaps one of the most important key points of the four causes. Because ultimately, just because someone has taken a block of stone and has chiseled it into a statue, it doesn't quite finish describing what's there. Is that statue an idol? Do people worship the statue? Is the statue an object of devotion, like we would see in our Catholic Church? In other words, the why is that statue was made to inspire us, to lift our thoughts, to think of the person represented in that statue. Is that statue merely a paperweight? Is it a knick-knack that sits on my shelf? Those are three different answers to the question, why, about what could be the same thing. So you see, it is an important part of what a thing is, its final cause. We do not have a complete picture of what a thing is without knowing its final cause. One of the things that first caught my attention when we went over this in philosophy class at seminary was that our teacher pointed out that, well, you know, the whole final cause thing has kind of fallen out of popularity lately. Most modern philosophers don't want to speak about a final cause. And you can kind of see why. Because modern philosophy, we want to deal more with concrete things. It's easy enough to describe material, formal, and efficient things. But why? That question is a little bit more of a puzzle. We don't like to deal with that, so ultimately, in modern philosophy, a lot of times, this fourth cause of Aristotle, why, the final cause, the telos, the thing towards which a thing is ended, gets kind of left by the wayside. In that context, I'd like to look now a little bit at the mission of Apollo 8. Now, we all know of Apollo 11. That is the famous moon landing of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins is up circling the moon in the command module. Everyone knows Apollo 11. That's kind of seen as the triumph, because again, when we set a goal and we work towards it, we really, you know, planting that flag on the moon for the first time, taking the first steps, that was a big deal. That was the achievement of Kennedy's goal. So that gets a lot of attention. But a lot of the other Apollo missions, they don't get much attention, and I'd like to focus particularly on Apollo 8 today. The mission of Apollo 8 is one that came about, again, because of Kennedy's vision. I've mentioned how all the decisions have to be formulated towards your end, if you know where you're going. Well, one of the things that came up was, we need a series of steps to get to the moon. And the rocket they were using to do it, which we'll talk more about, it had many different parts in different stages, and the plan, as with most software or anything you would develop technically, you test the individual pieces first. You make sure stage one of the rocket works before you try and put stage two, and then stage three, and stage four, and you do it in pieces to make sure all the pieces work before you put it all together. But because of the mission that they knew they had, Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon before the decade was out, it precluded this time frame of testing individual things over and over, and it was decided we just need to put the whole thing together. All the stages of the rocket, command module, service module, everything, let's just put it all out there in space right away, and since we're going to do that, let's just go to the moon. The number Apollo 8 might give us the impression that we'd have, like, you know, 8 Apollo missions before that. In fact, after the Apollo 1 fire, the other numbers, if you will, that would go up to that were just test launches of various things, and that there was no manned Apollo 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. The next manned Apollo mission was Apollo 7. It was the first test of the Apollo spacecraft going into space, and all they did was orbit around the Earth. When it came time for Apollo 8, its type of mission was then to be to orbit around the Earth and do a little bit more. And all of a sudden, they decided, this doesn't fit the time frame. We need to go to the moon now. So Apollo 8 was perhaps the biggest gamble in the entire space program. We would not have landed on the moon with Apollo 11 by the end of the decade were it not for Apollo 8. Apollo 8 was the first mission to ever send a man to the moon. They went all the way to the moon and for the first time entered into lunar orbit. They were the first men ever to see with human eyes the backside of the moon, what we call the dark side. They were the first ones to fully test out the technology of the full Apollo program. There's only one little rocket on the little spacecraft that goes around the moon, and it has to work, or you just get stuck at the moon forever. There were a lot of questions. This was a prime example of something that NASA would say, we would never do this today. Far too dangerous. We gambled everything on this one mission. But this one worked. And we would not have achieved our mission were it not for this extraordinary Apollo 8. But one of the unique things about this mission, you know, NASA being engineers, very, very structured, focused, checklist after checklist of every little detail. They had, you know, you think you go to the moon, it takes 3 days to get there, 3 days to come back. You're in space for 14 days on a full lunar mission. They had every little minute planned out on that mission. You know, at 47 seconds past the hour, you know, Bill Anders will take the camera. At 49 seconds, he will point it out the window. He will take a picture of the following three objects. He will then stow the camera. Just to give you an idea, there was a 40-step process to go to the bathroom. So there was a checklist for everything. Every little thing was structured. So they knew exactly what they were going to do, believe it or not, for every second of the 14-day mission. But something interesting happened. They get out to the moon. It's interesting because they don't see the moon as they're coming because of the way the capsule is oriented. They're leaving Earth for the first time, and they don't see the moon until they get right next to it. And they get to the backside of the moon, and they realize all the stars disappeared. And there's just this black emptiness. And they realize we're on the dark side of the moon. And they knew this was going to happen. They planned it. It happened right on schedule. Everything like clockwork. They are preparing. But the next thing that's going to happen is that when you go around the moon, now the moon is in between you and the Earth, and the radios can't communicate. So there's what's called loss of signal. They can't talk to anybody. They are expecting that when they come around the backside of the moon and are able to have Earth there again, the next thing on their checklist is they will reacquire communication with NASA back in Houston. But something very unexpected happens at that point. Right as they're coming around the back side of the moon and are starting to see light again, they reposition the spacecraft to get the antenna pointed towards Earth, and all of a sudden, for the first time, as they're looking out over the surface of the moon, they start to see the Earth rise over the horizon of the moon. It was at that moment that panic broke loose in the cabin because this was not on the checklist. They had not expected this at all. But Frank Borman, the commander, looks out the window and just says, "Oh my God, you gotta see this." And they look out their windows and like, "Whoa, will you look at that?" I mean, these astronauts, which, I mean, in their communications to Houston are all very specific. Houston, this is Apollo 8. We need cryogenic stir on this tank at this. Like, all of a sudden, what you hear on the loop is, "My God, what's that?" I mean, they just are lost for a second. And all of a sudden, there's this mass flurry. "Get the cameras!" And they grab as quick as they can, because it wasn't on the list of pictures to take. Like, they know exactly every frame they're going to take, but all of a sudden, they're like, "Quick, grab the cameras, grab the cameras." And they're snapping pictures of the Earth rising over the moon. It was at that moment that Bill Anders, who was in the right seat of the cabin, took the picture that you see on your paper there. It is entitled Earthrise. It was the first time that man ever looked back at the Earth from the moon. And it was not on the list of pictures to be taken. It was completely unexpected. But this is what all the astronauts on that mission pointed to as perhaps one of the most moving parts of the mission. They just saw the moon for the first time, and yet it was looking back at the Earth and seeing it rise above the horizon of the moon that most captured their attention. Bill Anders would later be quoted as saying, "You know, after all the training and studying we had done as pilots and engineers to get to the moon safely and get back, and as human beings to explore moon orbit, what we really discovered was the planet Earth." Many things came out of this. All of a sudden, the environmental movement was born, for instance. Jim Lovell, who is Tom Hanks in Apollo 13. He was in the center seat on this. Jim Lovell later remarked about the most extraordinary thing he experienced was when they came around for this Earthrise. He realized he could stick his thumb up and cover the entire Earth with just his thumb. He thought, "Everything that I know and love, everything I've ever understood, I can just cover with my thumb." This was an amazing moment for the astronauts and in the pictures that they took for the rest of the country. For the first time, our vision was expanded. When you're just in orbit around the Earth, I mean, you get a sense of the curvature of the Earth. But it wasn't until they got away at the moon and could see just this little blue ball out there in the blackness of space that they really got a new perspective on what the Earth is about. This mission took place in December of 1968. In fact, it was on Christmas Eve that they were orbiting around the moon, and they were scheduled to give a television broadcast. At this point, we had figured out how to do TV from space, and it was to be the largest television audience to ever see anything in the history of television, or to ever witness anything together in the history of mankind. And so the people down at Mission Control told the astronauts, you better come up with something good to say. There was problems on previous missions where maybe people had made light of the space program. They had often named their command modules Gumdrop and Spider or Snoopy and things. So they wanted this to be a little more serious. So, like, 2 billion people will be listening to you. Come up with something good. And what came over them as they looked back at Earth from the moon was that they realized a little bit the question of why. We look at the Earth. Why? Why is it there? Who made it? What is it? What is it made out of? But why does it exist? Why does the Earth exist? And so with 2 billion people, more than half of the people alive in the world at that time, watching, some of the most famous words spoken were heard by the entire world. As they got ready to end their broadcast, they said, "Crew of Apollo 8 has a message we wish to share with the people back on Earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light,' and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning, the first day. God said, 'Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate waters from waters.' And God made the expanse, and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, 'Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear.' And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good." The mission commander, Frank Borman, then signed off the broadcast on that Christmas Eve, wishing everyone a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you. All of you on the good earth. When these great engineers and scientists got to their objective, the moon, they looked back on the earth, and these engineers and scientists chose to ponder the question of why. Why is the earth there? And their answer was, in the beginning, God. God did this. God made this little blue ball that is our home. God separated that blue from that brown, made the land, made the seas. How amazing that is, that they are able, in all their scientific training, we tend to think of scientists as being very objective, very focused in the concrete and the sensible and the tangible. And here they look at the earth, and with all their science, their thoughts are of the God who made this and what it means that that is our little home. They could have thought, how insignificant, how nothing. Instead, they thought, how special that in the midst of all this blackness, and that's one of the things the astronauts always describe, you don't understand how black space is. In the midst of this little blackness is this little blue ball that God made for us. It answers the question, why? It's for us. St. Peter Chrysologus, one of the doctors of the church, asks, why do you ask how you were created and do not seek to know why you were made? Was not this entire visible universe made for your dwelling? It was for you that the light dispelled the overshadowing gloom. For your sake was the night regulated and the day measured. And for you were the heavens embellished with the varying brilliance of the sun, the moon, and the stars. Answers the question, why? Why the earth? We can look at what it's made out of. We can say what form it's in. But then we have to ask, who? Who made it? What is the efficient cause? But more importantly, why? The answer is that God made it, and he made it for us. This is an important lesson, I think, for all of us, particularly in science, but really in every field. Because we tend today to look at science as almost kind of a disproving of God, or thinking we can explain everything. We are like those NASA engineers who made the checklists, to think we can script every little minute, describe every little thing, and then all of a sudden, what we need is to not miss that moment when the unexpected happens and we stop to ponder why. The church sometimes gets a bad rap with science, thinking that somehow faith and reason are opposed, that faith involves believing in things that are illogical, that we can't see or understand, and we just believe it on faith, as if faith were some kind of blind thing. Faith, rather, is intimately connected with reason. It was perfectly reasonable for the astronauts, as they looked back at the Earth, to ponder not just what is there and how it's there, but why. It was perfectly natural to them. It was what came first as they saw it. And it is perfectly natural that a scientist, anyone who is seeking knowledge, science just means knowledge, so it doesn't have to be what we would consider the sciences today. It goes for the arts, languages. Anytime we seek knowledge, ultimately, it has always been the case that man seeks knowledge to come closer to God. Even if we don't realize that, the more we seek to know about our world, the more we seek to know about ourselves, the more we are really asking the question, why? Why am I here? Who made me? This, I think, is the important mission that we can have as Catholic educators. Because you see, it's always been Catholics, ironically, who have been the scientists at the forefront of the great advances in science. We're familiar with some of the more famous cases. Gregor Mendel, who discovered modern genetics with his pea plant experiments. He was an Augustinian monk. He was inspired to know more about God through knowing more about genetics. He thought, if I can get to know a little bit about the efficient cause, the material cause, how it's all put together, I can get to know a little bit more about God. You know, when the Apollo crew got done reading from Genesis, they got home to immediately find out they were being sued by an atheist, that they shouldn't be using television and the airwaves to quote the Bible. But ultimately, the people who have always been at the forefront of science have always come away with a great appreciation for God. This is true not just of Gregor Mendel, but for instance, the priest Copernicus. We're all familiar with Galileo, but it was really the priest Copernicus who first said that the Earth is the center of our solar system, and the sun is the center of our solar system, the Earth goes around it. We all think that was Galileo, but that was really a priest, Copernicus, who first posited that theory. And interestingly, we know about Galileo because he got in lots of trouble. But if Copernicus already had this idea, why didn't Copernicus get in trouble? It's because when Copernicus came up with the heliocentric theory of the universe, he stuck to science, and Galileo got into trouble when he tried to not only say the Earth goes around the sun. But then he tried to also, as all scientists had done, answer the question, why? And Galileo wanted to say that why of this means that there is no God. That the earth is really just insignificant. It wasn't created with any special purpose. You see, he's beyond science now, and he's into the question of why. And he got in trouble with the church, ultimately, because he had the wrong answer to the question, why? What would it mean to say that the earth goes around the sun? For Galileo, it meant that man is insignificant then. We're not a special creation. This isn't a special planet. It's just an accident. We can see right away that that's why Galileo got in trouble with the church. And ever since, there's this myth that somehow the church is opposed to science. We know that, of course, the Vatican has its own observatory and does a lot of great work studying the stars and has been one of the forefront of that. The moral there is, we should willingly go out and learn everything we can about the world. We should never be afraid of science. Science can help us learn the whats and the hows of the material universe. But it can't answer the question why. For that we need not just reason, but faith too. We need to know something about the God who made all this physical world if we're really going to fully understand the world in which we live. We have to have someone to teach us about the answer of the question why. When the Apollo astronauts got back to the Earth, they sent their pictures out, and that Earthrise picture appeared in Time magazine and all around, and it had a profound effect on all the people. They then began to ask questions like, what does this mean? There, I think, is the question that still gets asked today. This is the question, I think, primarily that our students need to know. Any school can teach people a lot about the whats and the wherefores, and you know, we can teach them all about the math, the science, the reading, languages, music. Any school can do that. We can teach you how to play an instrument well. We can teach you how to do calculus. We can teach you how to do the chemistry experiment right. We can teach you how to write. We can teach you how to speak a foreign language. As a Catholic school, our mission cannot be just to do that, the same thing that the public schools do, and just do it better, or even to try to do it as good. That can't be our mission. We're just like everybody else then. The unique gift of Catholic education is that we have not only the ability to certainly teach all the stuff and to do it good, and many times we do it better than the public schools, and that draws a lot of people to us. But ultimately, that is not our mission. Our unique gift as a Catholic school is that we are able to give not only that, but to answer the question, why? We can tell our students not just what, but what it means. Why? Think about your own field. All of us here have many different things that we teach. Perhaps we're inclined to say we're a Catholic school, and that means that we have a theology department, and they'll teach about God, and so our school's Catholic because we teach about God, and theology is part of our curriculum. I'd say that if that's all we do, we are really missing the mission of Catholic education, because society is already fine with compartmentalizing faith as one aspect of our lives. You know, I'd have my job throughout the week, and then I go to church on Sunday, and that's my faith. I do that on Sunday. We can run the risk of treating our faith like that in the school, too. That we're a Catholic school, therefore we have this department that takes care of faith. And that's nice, that we have the ability to have a theology department in our school. That's good. But we can almost do a disservice if we think that that's it. Because answering the question of why is ultimately one that fits in every field. If you teach music, why is it that a major chord, a major triad, draws joy and this sense of peace and happiness? And what is it about a minor triad that kind of gives us this eerie, foreboding feeling? Why? Well, God made something in us that responds to that. Why do we love these Shakespearean plays so much? What is it about a Shakespearean tragedy that so captivates our attention to this day that a play written hundreds of years ago has to be taught over and over again to every generation? Is there something of that tragedy that runs in our own human condition, that we can see our own tragic fall, and that all of us experience a little bit of this fallenness, and that we're all bent towards the precipice of tragedy in our lives? What is it about this chemistry, this mixing of elements, that is so fascinating? Why is that? Maybe God, in His mixing of the elements to create the universe, maybe we feel like we experience a little bit of that creative joy. I know in my own science classes at the University of Kansas, a particularly, you know, not certainly secular, maybe even atheist university, one time in my, I was in a biology class, I think it was an anthropology class, and we're talking about evolution. And, you know, he's going through all of the what that happened to bring about the stuff, the material cause. But then at the end, I'll never forget this, he had to stop and say, you know, I wouldn't be scientifically honest if I didn't tell you this. I've described what has happened, or at least the best I can, in all the reactions and the molecules and how they came together to make human beings. But I got to tell you, something that has always bugged me, from a statistical, biological bent as a scientist, I'm speaking totally as a scientist now, he reassured us, I know my statistical biology, and, you know, we're made up of lots and lots of molecules. Proteins go together to make DNA. We have all these DNA chromosomes. They're made up of little amino acids that go together to make up billions and billions of billions of little amino acids that go to make up just one little gene. He said, you know, in amino acid, there are thousands of little proteins that go to make that up. And statistically, I got to tell you, being honest, as a statistician, it is statistically zero possibility that even one little protein could have randomly happened. It's 0.0 to an infinite regression of zeros to get to maybe a one, and that one's only there because I can look and see that it is, but I can't tell you why it happened. It just is, and it statistically shouldn't be there. Now, you can call that God or whatever you want to, but I'm telling you from science, it doesn't make sense from a purely scientific standpoint. That was a great gift that professor was able to give, because it shows us that we can use our reason to arrive at God, too. That science will never explain everything, and it certainly won't tell us what it's all about, or why we even care. One of the greatest questions we can ever ask is, why is there something rather than nothing? As much as we could move backwards towards, let's say, a Big Bang, that we could, let's say we could explain everything in the universe from a Big Bang. Well, what went bang? And why? And how did it get there? Why are there laws of the universe in the first place? All these things are great ways that, as a Catholic educator, we can get in there and answer that question of why, and feed our students with more than just what they could get in the public schools. And I would posit that that is the most important thing that they will learn. If they see that their chemistry teacher, their physics teacher, their English teacher, their drama teacher, their music teacher, if every one of you takes the opportunity to point out that answer to some of the questions of why, to bring our faith into whatever subject it might be, then you are teaching ultimately the most important lesson, and that is that our faith hinges on everything. There is nothing that is outside of or immune from the touches of God and our faith. That, I think, is ultimately a question of where. That's part of our mission, to answer that question of why. We needn't feel that somehow we do a disservice to our field if we bring our faith into it. Rather, the opposite is true. If we fail to tell the students what it all means, we've missed the most important part. Ultimately, as we look back, we can see from the Psalms that even in those early days of King David, far from what we knew about the solar system and everything now, when he looked at all that, he has a reaction that hopefully we can help our students to see, and that is to see God in everything in this life. David says in Psalm 8, "When I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? Mortal men that you care for them. Yet you have made him little less than a god, crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him rule over the works of your hands, put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and whatever swims in the path of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how awesome is your name through all the earth." That's the kind of inspiration that we want to bring to our students. To have them, as the Apollo astronauts did, look at what they see and to see God, to see why. The Apollo astronauts could have easily looked at the earth and said, "Wow, isn't life meaningless? It's just an insignificant little thing." Instead, they said, "Look at what God did, and isn't it special?" They asked the question, why, and they answered it with God. May we do the same for all of our students as we help them to understand the most important question they could ask, why? Mentioned that we'll take a little time now for perhaps some silent reflection if you'd like, and then break off into groups, maybe five or six or so, whatever group you feel comfortable with. And I'd like you in your little group, as long as you want. We have lunch at noon, so we've got just about an hour and 20 minutes before lunch for you to spend as you'd like. But I'd like you to consider the questions amongst yourselves, to share a little bit, since we are from diverse fields, how have you, in your own classes, found ways to bring your faith into it, to integrate answering that question, why, into your daily teachings and your classrooms, to hear how your colleagues have dealt with that subject, to see how we could do a better job of that, and then to just maybe share some from your own life, the things that you've discovered that most have been those moments for you, like the Apollo 8 astronauts had. How can we, as educators, allow our students to have that experience like the Apollo 8 crew did, that they too can find themselves wherever they're at and be surprised, to be bowled over as they discover something they didn't expect, as they find God somewhere they never would have expected? How can that happen in your field, and to share a little bit about that and get some ideas from your colleagues, and feel free to talk also just whatever you want. Talk so far today, and then we're going to have lunch at noon, and then we'll gather, we'll stay after lunch over in the formation room to just do kind of a little bit of group sharing, some of the things that ideas you come up with or stories you want to share from your individual discussions. We'll then come back together after lunch, and we'll just stay over in the formation room for a little brainstorming session and sharing to hear some of those ideas and anything else you want to talk about. The Holy Spirit is kind of always a leader of a retreat, so any place you feel the Spirit leading you, feel free to follow those inspirations shortly. So let's end this morning session of talks with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Dear God, we continue to place ourselves in your hands. You have created everything. You have created everything for us. The universe, the work of your hands, as awesome as it is even more awesome to think that you made all this for us. Help us to understand this great beauty of what you've done. Help us to share it with others. Help us to have those beautiful experiences as we find you in new and unexpected ways in our lives. Keep us faithful to our mission. Help always that we would keep in mind the students that we serve, that we may bring you to them and bring them closer to you through your church. We ask all this through Christ our Lord. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.